The U.S. military will not have to remove Saddam Hussein from power after he leaves voluntarily to host the new $20,000 pyramid.
From two corners of the world, it's That's the Thing, the film podcast where twin critics talk about, well, what else? Films. I'm your host, Nick Cooey, and as always, I'm being joined by my co-host, Alex. I'm out here in Beaconsfield, Great Britain. He is located just on the outskirts of Minneapolis, Minnesota. And today's date is October the 1st, 2020. And Alex, how are you doing on this October day?
I'm doing fine. I can't complain. And I'm glad that you mentioned it's October, because I'm going to have to be making some Halloween plans and adjusting them in light of the pandemic.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'm doing good. You know, I'm cool. How are you? How are things going in England?
Yeah, you know, I'm staying cool as a cucumber myself. I'm just getting prepped for the London Film Festival. The first spate of industry screenings will be occurring tomorrow on the 2nd of October. So I'm going to be spending quite a bit of time writing about films over the next week and a half, 2 weeks almost. And you know, I'm excited. I'm excited to finally, after having just a little bit of, just a little trickle of new films over the last few months, having quite a number to choose from and to write about for the website. So probably by the time this podcast gets published, you'll be seeing some of these reviews already uploaded onto the site. But keep an eye peeled for some of those to be popping up all the way through the middle of October. But for now, I'm content to sit around with you, sip a glass of wine on this gorgeous Thursday evening that we're having, and talking about yet another title in our 2000 retrospective.
And I'm glad to. I'm also taking a moment to talk about another film from 2000 with you, because I've been also busy too, watching a lot of movies from the New York Film Festival and trying to get those written down too for the site, which I can't wait to share with you guys my thoughts on them, because there are lots of good titles out there.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hearing what you've got to write. But in terms of the movie we're going to talk about today, today's film was something that I kind of chose because you had, this is another film that I had seen, but you hadn't. And it's a film from the Hungarian auteur Béla Tarr, and it is his 2 hour fable called Werkmeister Harmonies. Now, Alex, how familiar with you, just before we get into really talking about the film, how familiar were you with Béla Tarr, either in terms of this film or his filmography in general?
Well, I have to be honest, I think I might have heard the title thrown around here or there, but not so much the director's name. I wasn't really familiar with him. In fact, I think the first time that you mentioned his name to me, I kind of got him mistaken. I got him mixed up with the composer, Béla Bartók.
No, not quite the same. I mean, though, I mean, of course, even the title of this movie is referencing a composer, though. It's a German composer, but we'll get to that in a minute. But this was the first time, really, you had seen any Béla Tarr film, let alone Werkmeister Harmonies.
Yeah, Werkmeister Harmonies was the first of his films I've seen. Though since then, like, as a means of, like, trying to prepare for the podcast, I also saw his 1988 film Damnation that was playing in a new restoration during the New York Film Festival.
Yeah, I mean, which is great, because, I mean, over the last year, we've had Damnation get restored, we've had his 1994 epic Satan Tango released on Blu-ray, which, for cinephiles, that's a major get, and it's interesting that Tarr has been one of those figures who has kind of occupied the circles of cinephile regard or admiration and outright effusive praise since Satan Tango played in 1994. Of course, Satan Tango didn't really see a lot of wide exposure, primarily because the movie is 7 hours and 15 minutes long. So, naturally, that was going to be a tough sell for your local AMC or Everyman. But that's why it was interesting that 6 years after Satin Tango found its admirers in critics and cultural intellectual figures like Susan Sontag and Jonathan Rosenbaum, he began the new millennium with the Werkmeister Harmonies, which in terms of its length is certainly more palatable. It's just a 2-hour and 15-minute running time, so really it's kind of a breeze. But it didn't play in the official competition, interestingly enough. It played only in the director's fortnight, but it did end up garnering some effusive critical praise. And it's, over the last 20 years, like other films that we've been talking about on the podcast, has garnered a lot of praise as one of the most beloved films of the 21st century, let alone of the year 2000. I mean, it was interesting, even I just saw this in Slant Magazine's Best of the 2000s Decade list. Three of the films that they picked in the top 10 were from the year 2000. And those three movies were Yi, In the Mood for Love, and Werkmeister Harmonies. And now, we've already talked a bit about Yi and In the Mood for Love, and we both, as anybody who's heard those episodes can tell, we both love those movies to death. So clearly, Werkmeister Harmonies had its work cut out for it.
Yeah, it certainly did.
I mean, especially for you, Alex, considering this is your first time seeing it.
So what did I think, seeing it the first time?
Yeah.
Well, it was a very interesting experience for me, but in a very good way. Watching the film, it had this sort of, was like this hypnotic sort of effect on me. Like I was I was not just being transported to this world that feels kind of like our world, but slightly heightened to realism. But I felt like I was floating throughout the entire film. I'm just floating and observing this world and these characters, and watching what feels like a dream, but then what turns soon into this really this horrible, dreadful nightmare.
Well, I mean, I think that's a pretty apt comparison about the floating, because I mean, when you the first thing I think anybody notices when you see a Bela Tarr film, but especially Werkmeister Harmonies, is the cinematography. Because the camera work in this film is, I mean, just from the first shot, which is like about 11 minutes long, the camera, it's floating within a contained space of a bar specifically, isn't it? That we're just, what it is, it's just we're following this young man named Janos, who's sort of giving this peculiar demonstration of a solar eclipse, utilizing three very drunk men at closing time at this bar. And as he's causing the men to rotate around each other in this simulacrum of the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun, the camera itself is also following them, and it's floating around. And yeah, I just remember the first time I watched this film, or I tried watching this film like a few years ago. And honestly, like, when you say it's hypnotic, like the first time I tried watching this film about 3 years ago, I actually ended up falling asleep. And I think that's a testament to the film's power, because it is this it already, like from the opening shot, it introduces this very hypnotic and meditative quality that that can seem to be a little aimless or wandering, especially in kind of the roaming camera work. Wouldn't you agree? Or was, well, how was that? How was your impression as you were watching the film, in terms of that that camera work?
Well, what was interesting is that the camera work in the movie, which I think I should point out too, was done by 7 cinematographers actually. And we talked previously about In the Mood for Love, how we commended how seamless it felt the look between the two cinematographers. But I think it's amazing that there are 7 cinematographers, but it feels like a singular vision.
Oh, absolutely.
But with the camera work in this movie, it does move a lot, but it's not moving like super fast or anything. In fact, there are many times where, like, when it does a zoom out or so, or a zoom in on a subject or a figure, it takes its time deliberately with it. It's like it's demanding our patience, and It kind of reminded me of the great movies article I read by Roger Ebert, who it was kind of funny because he said that if, you know, that it's the film is maddening if you are not in sympathy with it, and mesmerizing if you are, and saying that if you don't walk out of the theater after 20 or 30 minutes, you won't be able to leave your seat. And I thought that was a very apt description of the movie. And what I also find interesting about the camera work, and I noticed this too in Damnation, was that I think Tarr, what he loves to do is, and what I really admire him for, is that when he ends a scene, like, say, character something happens, an event finishes, and, like, characters are walking away or leaving, then usually, like, maybe the director would cut to the next scene, like that. But he decides to wait a little bit before he cuts. It's like he lets the scene linger on for just a little more. Maybe because I feel he either wants to let it sink in, or maybe he wants to raise a sense of awareness, I think, too, kind of like some of the directors we have discussed, of how there's a world that goes beyond just the main story. I mean, it's like even when he was interviewed talking about Damnation, Bellatar said he actually felt there are several protagonists in the film, not just his lead actor, but also like the rain and the dogs. And I feel that's the case too in this film, where I feel there are many central major figures in it, not just Janus or any of the other characters, but the town itself, and also this giant whale that plays a very symbolic
part. We should probably give a little explanation, because from what we've been talking about, the first 10 minutes, it's the sort of ethereal, dreamlike quality, and you might think to yourself, well, what's the story? Well, actually, there is a story, and it's a really interesting one, because it's essentially about, this caravan comes into this unnamed Hungarian town, and it contains the carcass of a giant whale. And it's essentially charging admission for people to come into this dark little truck and to look at the whale. And I mean, and then there's this caretaker of the whale carcass who's only referred to as the prince. And sometimes he speaks to people on his tours with the whale. And we're kind of informed through exposition of that this whale, then that this prince figure, have been touring towns all over the countryside, and in their wake have been, as rumors would suggest, have been instigating some sort of social unrest. And I mean, this kind of remains within the realm of the conjectural and hypothetical. But when Janus first sees this whale, about half an hour into the film, when he first sees the whale, he considers it actually this testament to the divinity of to the presence of a divine order, that it is a tribute to the majesty of God's creation. And in a lot of respects, the film is, among many other things, it's a film about faith and faith being challenged, isn't it? Because what Janos learns or confirms about some of these suspicions about this whale and this prince come to really shake his faith.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of summarizing the film without getting to spoilers, because, then there are turns the plot takes, which then lend to its nightmarish quality that we discuss. But I agree with you in that it is about him coming to terms with and having his faith challenged. That's one of the ways you can look at it. And it's interesting because whenever Bellatar, I've seen in interviews of him being discussed, about describing his movies, he's notable for, like, he doesn't really like to discuss them in allegorical terms, or say if they're about this or that. Like if somebody one time asked him, oh, would you say this film is a parable about, like, capitalism? And he said, no, it's about a whale comes to a town, you know. And so he's a little coy and tongue-in-cheek in his answer, even though it's interesting because maybe there's a little bit of a philosophical mindset that he has, because he did he had at one point considered to be a philosopher before he went on to become a director.
Right. And I mean, and that's certainly that prefigures quite a bit within movies like Werkmeister Harmony, where kind of the intersection between philosophy and faith generate this question of
what does it mean to pursue the what is the pursuit of ascribing significance to something? And Tar definitely has been categorized in the past as a nihilist, in the respect that his films sort of are confronted with these as, you know, something miraculous or extraordinary, like this giant dead whale, and he simply is presenting it as, I mean, that even though there are certain meanings ascribed to it, that either it's a testament to divine creation, or if it's an instigator for anarcho-fascist violence. Tar is trying to kind of, he's not as interested in picking one or two of these significant meaning, or he's not interested in just only picking one of these meanings as much as he's just interested in the way that human beings come to latch these meanings onto these objects.
Yeah, I think so too. I mean, and we were, you know, and we were discussing too about the meaning of the title Werkmeister Harmonies, and I think I'm glad that you thought we should discuss it, because you're right, it is very crucial to the whole meaning of the film itself, because the it's actually based on a book called The Melancholy of Resistance by the novelist and co-screenwriter Laszlo Krasznahorkai, who had actually co-written Tar's film since Damnation. And the Werkmeister Harmonies was the name of one of the chapters of this book, but it takes a prevalence as being the title of this movie, because there's a scene where there's this old man who Janusz lives with, Gori is his name, and he has been working on trying to work on this theory where he wants to put it in straightforward terms, he wants to kind of bring music back into a period before Andreas Werkmeister brought about his theory, to kind of to bring a more of an equal temperament to the music, and right. How he yearns for the days of Pythagoras.
Well, who, I mean, well, what he's talking about his. Well, I mean, I think it's important to note that just when he's raising up Pythagoras, and specifically in its relation to Andreas Werkmeister and his musical theory pertaining to the Werkmeister temperament. Now, I'd just like to preface this by also saying that neither of us are musical theorists, but from what I understand, there is definitely a strain of mathematical precision in terms of Werkmeister's approach towards tuning, specifically in relation to music. And what Uncle Gyuri, what he says in this long monologue is, he is, as you said, he's trying to ponder this question that, as he puts, is not technical so much as it is philosophical, in terms of returning to this sense of a natural, almost aleatory state, where each whole tone within an octave is regarded particularly as a separate entity, rather than this perfect component within a larger whole. And so, and then he says even specifically that because it's less a question of a technical degree and a philosophical degree, that it does extend towards one of faith. And I think that's interesting, that Tar, like, he is taking some of these themes of faith and philosophical inquiry, and he's channeling it through this prism of one very particular German musical composer and theorist.
Yeah, it's interesting. But I also, what I got out of it too, is in the monologue, as he says, how when he's talking about the days of Pythagoras and Aristoxenes, you know, as he says, quote, "When our forefathers were satisfied with the fact that their purely tuned instruments were played only in some tones, because they were not troubled by doubts, for they knew that heavenly harmonies were the province of the gods." And this is in reference to how Pythagoras believed in the harmony of the spheres, which is the belief of the movements of the celestial bodies, like the sun and the moon and stars, but in the form of music. And but looking at this through mathematical terms instead, as opposed to oral. But how, as he says, in our arrogance, how we try to essentially channel and match that power of the gods. And I think that's something that's built up throughout the whole movie, about that thirst and crave for power. And that power,
and even just the likening of the cosmos, is just, as we've noted, established right from the opening shot of the film.
Yeah, exactly. And Yeah, exactly. I think you can tie that into his opening monologue, and then eventually how there's a monologue that occurs later in the movie, which I won't give away, but I think you know which one I mean. And it's the one where we kind of realize that of when the film sort of begins its descent into nightmarish state of mind. So I think I like how those three sort of compare and contrast with each other. And it's like the idea of the purpose of it is not just in terms of philosophical terms, but also about an humanitarian means of like I said, the desire for power and for control, but how there's the risk of that of trying to be almost at a godlike status, but that comes at the expense of empathy and decency, not just for your fellow man, but for your environment. I mean, the fact of like trying to, it's almost like displaying this whale carcass around town. It's like a perversion of something so beautiful, this leviathan, almost godlike creature.
Or conversely, because of the deification of this dead whale, it's ignoring the fact that it's just a dead whale. And which sounds bleak, but I mean, Tar is, he's been known to be bleak, and this is a bleak film, I would say. And I think it's really interesting that you raise up this question of the pursuit of power, and specifically what a movie like Werkmeister Harmonies is doing is that it illustrates that pursuit of power within a political, even though Tar has refuted any overt readings of a political nature into the film, it nevertheless has this sort of subplot concerning an aunt of Janos named Aunt Tunda, who's played by Hana Shiguya, who a lot of you listeners, any of you listeners out there who are fans of Rainer Werner Fassbinder, you'll recognize her as his muse. And it's a real treat seeing her in this film to kind of play this older woman who asks Janos to go around town and collect names on a list for the purposes of reestablishing law and order, because there is a lot of talk of unrest and social malaise, and what the specific root of that malaise kind of remains not really clearly established. There are sort of some vague references that the film makes in terms of medicine shortages from out of town. There's a coal shortage in terms of lack of electricity and power, but it never situates you within a particular instance of, oh, we have to be within this era of Hungarian history or like this country's history. Like, it's in that way, what's interesting about the film is that it can be seen as sort of a timeless amalgamation of different social orders on the cusp of collapsing into a failed state. But now I wanted to ask you, Alex, how do you feel about the film being characterized as a timeless fable? Because it is a fable, but would you consider it timeless?
You know, I think I would. I think because of how it is set in this quiet little town, so you don't really get to see like an urban metropolitan city or anything like that, and that way you can use your imagination on setting it in almost any period of time. I mean, granted, it doesn't look like it's set in the medieval ages, per se, but I think with the content of the story itself, and as you put it, I think you can apply it to any kind of a place in the world, not just to Hungary, but you could even apply it to the United States or the United Kingdom, of these small-town communities where a lot of fear and paranoia and unrest and anger are thriving and brimming beneath the surface until eventually it erupts and turns into this nightmarish, almost cataclysmic rise of authoritarianism and fascism.
Right.
And honestly, you know, it was kind of weird because watching the film, even though I think the pacing and the execution is very, very different from this other one, but it kind of reminded me of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, in that it's also a story where, even though I think it's more subdued, and you don't realize at first when you're watching Werkmeister, but how there is this tension that's prevalent throughout the entire picture, and then, you know, something's going to give way, and then when it does, then you kind of, you sit back and watch with absolute horror and shock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it is something where, I mean, gradually the film feeds you these little clues, you know, whether it includes sort of these congregations outside of the caravan with the whale, or again with this with just this invocation of law and order as a political weaponized, you know, when it's being weaponized. I mean, that is something that it does slowly plant these seeds of doubt, and then when you kind of realize how everything's falling into place, it's too late, of course. And when Janos realizes all of these things when they fall into place, it's too late, and you can only, as you said, sit back and witness. And I mean, and I think that's sort of that all culminates really in just this scene that the first time I saw the film, I was really blown away by it. Though I have to say that the person I watched it with, we were watching it in a cinema at the school, and he paused halfway through to go use the bathroom, and I was so angry with him. I mean, and the people I'm watching with too, they were all like, "Is this guy for real? Like, what the fuck is wrong with him?"
Yeah, but it's a sequence that you don't want to pause in the middle. You have to sit down and watch it the entire
all the way through, and the entire way through, exactly. Because what Tar is doing as well, it's like it is like a set piece, but the way that he executes it, the camera acts as the surrogate for the audience. And so what we're doing is we're floating through this, essentially it's a hospital, and we're floating through this hospital as we sort of witness people being dragged from hospital beds, and some of the violence we witness, other bits of the violence we only hear off screen. And of course there's no music whatsoever. And so what Tar is doing is that he is immersing us in, we're becoming immersed within this nightmarish scenario where we can't really escape from, you know. It's and the thing is, he's not simply just cataloging the action and that's all that we see. As you said, he's reinforcing not only is that there's this broader world outside of what we see beyond the confines of the frame, but the fact that what is beyond the confines of the frame is all-encompassing and it's oppressive. And that
also what's interesting about the scene is that when it happens, like, you do get some sound effects, like you hear equipment being tossed, hurled to the floor, or beds being turned over, but you don't hear any like human grunts or screams. And so again, that's adds that heightened realism, that dreamlike status, where it feels otherworldly.
And there's just this moment where the scene, the whole sequence, just culminates that's so achingly sad that it catches us off guard, and I do think it actually reinforces something of a humanitarian concern within Tar, that as someone who's bleak and as someone who, yes, he's nihilistic, but that doesn't mean that he's completely devoid of interest or compassion for his fellow human beings. I mean, I think that's what makes a film like Werkmeister Harmonies actually more than just simply a purely cynical exercise in style. It's that it's actually a very clear-eyed and mournful vision of something that I think the author of the book of The Melancholy of Resistance and his co-writer had Laszlo Krasznahorkai, as you put it earlier, there was this little passage from the book that I thought was really, I only read the first chapter of the book and it opens very differently from the film, but there is this one little passage that I think captures a lot of the spirit of Werkmeister Harmonies, the film. And if I may, I'll read it for you very quickly.
Please do.
He writes, "All normal expectations went by the board and one's daily habits were disrupted by a sense of ever-spreading, all-consuming chaos, which rendered the future unpredictable, the past unrecallable, and ordinary life so haphazard that people simply assumed that whatever could be imagined might come to pass, that if there were only one door in a building, it would no longer open, that wheat would grow head downwards into the earth, not out of it, and that, since one could only note the symptoms of a disintegration, the reasons for it remaining unfathomable and inconceivable, there was nothing anyone could do except to get a tenacious grip on anything that was still tangible. So essentially what that all means to say is that when we're thrust, that I think Werkmeister harmonies thrusts us into the visual equivalent of this situation, that where we are within an ahistorical context or an ahistorical world that is deprived of a greater context. And that's why I asked you earlier, Alex, about the question of timelessness with the film, because honestly, I would argue that yes, the film is timeless in the sense that it's a fable, and that it, even though when it utilizes technology in the film, it's something that doesn't make it instantly anachronistic. It's more just like televisions or a helicopter in one sequence, but it's not something that you see and you think to yourself, oh, this is very clearly from the early 2000s. But I do think, nevertheless, that what Béliard is doing with this film is that he is drawing upon some attendant historical iconography from the 20th century specifically, and that is drawn from this rise of fascism, of totalitarianism, as well as an engagement with historical trauma that was also a feature within some of the classic Hungarian filmmakers. Like, for example, one of the biggest influences on Tar, this Hungarian filmmaker named Miklós Jankso, he made several films like The Roundup and The Red and the White. And aesthetically, you can see when you watch one of his films where Béliard really got the long take from, in terms of just these elaborate tracking shots and camera movements that rise up into the air and back down and follow these complex blocking of actors in and out of the frame over sustained periods of time. But not just aesthetically, but also in terms of its engagement with history, a movie like The Roundup explicitly is about kind of the Habsburg Empire and their occupation of Hungary during the middle of the 19th century. But it's more implicitly a critique of the failed 1956 revolution that was staged against Soviet forces. And I think, you know, of course, that was meant to sort of navigate around codes of censorship and to not instigate the ire of the party. But I think what's interesting is that Tar takes that fundamental approach of conveying sort of the subtext of something, but he's more abstract, and he's extrapolating from these specific instances of historical and political and social trauma to generate larger meanings or generate larger queries concerning how we perceive death, rationality, morality, order, chaos. I mean, it's an interesting thing to contrast too with, you know, a filmmaker like, I don't know if you've seen Alexei German, any of his films, but he's a Russian filmmaker.
No, I have not.
He made his last film, Hard to Be a God, I think I've told you about a couple of times. And I think that superficially that film relates, it has a lot in common with something like Werkmeister harmonies, where it's black and white. There are a lot of these long, elaborate takes. But of course, like, that film is very much playing with this question of history as well, because it's a science fiction film that takes place hundreds of years into the future on a planet that's stuck in this medieval world as if the Renaissance never happened. So this whole question of what's the difference between future and past, what happens when there is no connection to history, you know, and what does that do to a sense of, you know, on a psychological and political sense. I mean, it's an interesting comparison to the way that Tar takes him similar terrain, but he adopts it into slightly more, I would argue, into this framework of considering the prior century and what we can try to grasp from that as we head into the 21st century. I mean, that's, for me, that's my reading of, I mean, of course he might be hearing this and be like, oh, that's not at all what I was, it's just a story about a whale. What are you talking about? But to me, that's,
Béliard's,
that's
probably just chuckling hearing your opinion. He'll probably say, well, if that's what you think.
but to me, like, that's actually what makes Werkmeister harmony so interesting as well, is that it is like, he is generating this sort of, this question for us to consider about, well, if this is sort of the nightmare of the 20th century, and we're waking up into the 21st century. Where do we go from here?
Yeah.
And yeah, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, I mean, and it's interesting how I think Tar, he can raise up these discussions and themes that are essentially universal and timeless, but how, you know, when you were mentioning his influences too, how that were taken from his experiences and upbringing in Hungary, because Hungary is a country which has had a rather tumultuous history. It's still going through a bit of a crisis still to this day, you know, like even with after the film came out, there were the 2006 protests following the corruptions of left-wing party leaders.
Right.
And how that gave way to, they fell apart into now there you have these right-wingers that are in power and like they've been under controversy even from the European Union.
Right. So like Viktor Obrak, the prime minister, has really kind of taken Hungary, and I mean within an international sphere, Hungary has transitioned from what has been kind of regarded as a democratic state to something of a, to put it generously, a hybrid regime, which is erring closer to the side of totalitarianism. And Tar has actually spoken out explicitly against Obrak, as well as other nationalists like Marine Le Pen and Donald Trump. And I think, and so again, like, even though Werkmeister Harmenies is not only a political film, that isn't to say that Béla Tarr is not political as an individual, or that he doesn't have this understanding of political history in the way that it's charting the course of the future.
And just because he has themes which could be placed within our landscapes or our environment doesn't mean that he doesn't take it from his environment. I mean, at one point there was an interview where the interviewer was talking about how his films typically, you know, he likes to shoot his movies like in these muddy and ugly environments, and he just simply said, "That's my country."
Right, right. That's right. Yeah, that was Jonathan actually asking him that question.
Yes, Jonathan Romney.
Yeah, yeah. That was a trip seeing like 20 years ago, Jonathan, before his hair turned gray. But I mean, I remember telling you something too, that when he compared himself to Tarkovsky, that Béla Tarr was distinguishing himself from Tarkovsky in the sense that when he says that when Tarkovsky uses rain, it purifies his character's mind, just makes mud.
Yeah, and I think that's, I thought it was kind of funny, but I also thought that that was very true, because as dark as Tarkovsky's movies could be, I mean, even when I told you I was watching them, you're like, oh my god. But I feel like at least some of his movies, they end with a sense of like spiritual reprieve and redemption. But that's not the case here in Werkmeister Harmonies or Damnation. I think that's why people consider them so nihilistic, even though there are moments where I could see why they compare him to Tarkovsky, like the scene when Janusz goes into the town square to see the whale, and you have these, and the people are staying in the town square, they're just standing like these little clusters amongst each other, and they're not really moving much, or even look like they're talking. You don't even hear any walla walla. So it feels sort of unreal watching. It kind of reminded me of actually a crowd scene near the ending of Nostalgia, honestly.
Hmm. No, I can absolutely see that. I mean, of course, in the floating camera work, there's definitely a lot of Tarkovsky in there.
Oh, yeah.
But it's interesting to think about the way that Tar has influenced subsequent generations too. I mean, I was, you know, we've been kind of talking about the Russians, you know, with Tarkovsky and Alexei German Sr., but I mean, thinking beyond kind of Eastern Europe, you have Gus Van Sant, who is really inspired by Béla Tarr with Jerry. And I mean, there is a little bit of that. You can kind of sense that sense of slow cinema with Jerry, you know, in terms of kind of, you watch these long tracking shots of two guys walking in profile, you know. And I mean, there's like one shot in Werkmeister Harmonies that it seemed like of Janos and his uncle Yuri walking, and they're talking.
Yeah, I was thinking of Jerry when I saw that shot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Because it's like, what, it's like a minute and a half, 2 minutes of where they don't say anything, they just keep walking. And,
yeah, it's 2 minutes before then they come across some other people, and the shot still keeps going when they're talking.
Yeah, of course, of course. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, in that way, absolutely, Béla Tarr is, he has his place within the tradition of slow cinema that a whole range of filmmakers, either who he's influenced, like Gus Van Sant, or Hubo, who directed last year's An Elephant Sitting Still. And then if you think of, but do you think about his contemporaries, like, I mean, he's very different, but someone like David Lynch, also, I would say, I think even though he operates in a very separate register of surrealism, there is, of course, that sense of slow cinema when you're watching the third season of Twin Peaks and there's the infamous floor sweeping scene. And you have to wonder, well, what's the significance of this? Why are we holding on this for so damn long? And Bélatar kind of, I think he instigates some of that same line of questioning as well. But you either kind of go with it, you accept it, as you were saying with Ebert, you accept the rhythm of it, you know, or you just have a hard time with it.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, that kind of slow cinema, it reminds me of a video I saw of Paul Schrader discussing about transcendental cinema. And with Schrader, he was talking about how, you know, these directors like Chantal Ackerman or Bresson or even Paul Polakowski, he was singling out of how they would like make the intentionally slow cinema, but like to lull people into this sort of transcendental state. And then maybe, it's like to challenge them into lulling them then. Or, and then all of a sudden you get something that kind of jolts them out of it. Like with Bresson, say at the end of Pickpocket, you have music suddenly coming in when there wasn't any music before. Or in an Ozu film, you have emotionally reserved people, and then suddenly a woman starts crying. And I think in Werkmeister Harmonies, it's a little more subdued and subtle, but I think it's one of those things where, again, as we were alluding to within the content of the film, you know, there's a moment in it where the story shifts and it takes that nightmarish descent. I think that's when it kind of changes gears for you. Like, the filmmaking doesn't really change anything in any way per se, but it's more like within the content itself and how we are on the same level as Janus with that horrific realization. That's what I get.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. For the sake of clarity, Paul Schrader has written extensively about it, about transcendental style. And he has singled out Ozu and Bresson and Dreyer. And I think it's interesting, though, comparing that sort of that disruption with other filmmakers like Michael Haneke, you know, in a movie like Cachet, you know, which lulls you into kind of this stupor, this sort of this rhythmic lull, and then he'll just inexplicably 20 minutes in have this extreme close-up of a chicken getting its head cut off, and then you're just completely nerve-jangled throughout the rest of the movie. You know.
Do you feel there's any moment like that in Werkmeister?
I don't think that there's any moment where it's like you feel nerve-jangled, but I do think there are moments where I would argue that the music is when things is, I think the music, which is very sparingly used, when it does come into the frame, it conveys this real significance. So like, for example, in the hospital scene that we were talking about earlier, there is a moment when the music enters, and it's not simply the sake that it's Tar trying to be sentimental. And I mean, some people could say, well, he doesn't need that. But like, I feel like it just still, like, it's because there's so much of the film that, especially in so many prolonged shots without music or dialogue, and it's just this diegetic sound, either of feet shuffling or of wind or of this sparse, stark landscape, that when the music does come in, it is actually something like, if not a yearning for the transcendent, at the very least, this evocation of the humanity, I would argue. And that actually, and the way that the music comes back at several points in the film, including the final shot of the film, I think is incredibly powerful, because a lot of film scores do insist on how you're supposed to feel during a film, unfortunately, or that there's this misconception that you have to utilize music in a way to direct you to feel a certain way. And what Tar does at the end of Werkmeister Harmonies with the music is that he suggests a feeling, but he doesn't direct it towards a definitive judgment on what the film means. He allows you to cultivate and foster different readings of the allegorical aspects of his fable, and
that may not ascribe to his reading necessarily, but it's the pursuit of knowledge through the construction of allegory that he's encouraging. And I think that's actually an extremely generous thing on his part as a filmmaker. And I would actually, he's a tough filmmaker, but I'd say he's actually a very generous filmmaker in a lot of respects.
I do think that he's a very intellectually rewarding filmmaker, and I'd also argue emotionally rewarding too, because of how, as we've said, I think his capacity for empathy and for humanity. And I do think that's why, you know, even though Werkmeister Harmonies, like, as I alluded to Roger Ebert saying, though I don't think that everyone will be able to sit through and watch it, but I do think that it's a film that I would definitely recommend to people
who's really interested in cinema. I'd say I would absolutely recommend it. I think if it's not a masterpiece, it's pretty close to one. I think it's just, I really think it's an extraordinary film.
Oh yeah, I do too. I think it's a masterpiece.
Yeah. And I mean, as we were talking about, I think it certainly retains tragically all too much relevance in 2020. I mean, maybe arguably even more so than it did in the year 2000. But I think it's important, though, that we have works of art like Werkmeister Harmonies, which feel like they could have been made today or yesterday, and which, especially in these times of isolation, really challenge us in terms of what living in an isolated state of mind produces within our sense of moral and ethical boundaries. It's a challenging work, but I think it's an extremely rewarding one. And if you've never seen any of Bélatar's films, I think it's a really good entry point. I can't recommend it highly enough.
Yeah, neither can I. I agree with you. I think it's a great entry point, and I would like to see some of his other works too, like The Turin Horse, and maybe when I set a day aside for myself, I'll see Set in Tango. But I think this is his best film I've seen so far, and might be for all we know, considering he's retired since The Turin Horse.
Right, which I still need to see too. But I remember the first time I watched Werkmeister Harmonies, then one of the students was like, okay, we're going to watch The Turin Horse tomorrow. And I was like, guys, give me a break.
Yeah, again, that's one thing like Tarkovsky, like, guys, let's take a breather here, please.
Yeah, exactly. But my hope is that once I'm done with my dissertation, that I'm going to get together with people in a socially distanced context, of course, and we will spend a day watching Set in Tango, hopefully on the big screen at school. So I'll have to let you guys know if that ever happens and what I think of it. But
I imagine that's another film I wish I could see on a big screen, because I imagine that would also look gorgeous.
Well, you know, I'll tell you what, originally I was going to see Set in Tango back. It was having a theatrical touring in the UK earlier in the spring, but of course it was set to screen in April, and you know, by mid-March everything shut down. So, you know, but better late than never.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I will say this, you know, one last thing about Werkmeister Harmonies. When you asked me kind of about disruptive moments, the one thing that did stick out to me is that there is this really great scene involving two children who, yeah, if you hate children,
they're like the sons of this police chief.
Yeah. And if you hate children, this scene will definitely confirm your hatred or reinforce that hatred.
Well, it's not only just because they're acting wild and crazy, and banging against, you know, items, and also one of them keeps screaming. But again, it ties into that foreshadowing that the film is building up about this violence, because one of the police chief's sons keeps shouting, "I'll hurt you even worse, or even more." And again, that kind of dread scene, it's kind of like seeing the early stages of fascism within this child.
Well,
it really kind of reminded me of when Winston Smith sees one of his co-workers' children in George Orwell's 1984, and he could see in the look of their eyes, like, oh yeah, they're definitely going to become agents of Big Brother.
And visually, Tar reinforces this with the fact that above this this very sparse bed or mattress, really, that the two boys kind of presumably sleep on, you see all these swords and a couple of pistols hanging above the bed. It is for all intents and purposes the quote unquote funniest scene in the movie, but like when I say funny, I mean it's like pitch black humor. So you know what I would say, like, watch Bellatar with the Coen brothers. I think you'd be very surprised at how well they complement one another, even though they're extremely different in a lot of respects.
I've heard that comparison. But, you know, speaking of, like, maybe taking a break from Bellatar and focusing on other works, I thought maybe now would be a good time to transition to see if we have any weekly recommendations for our viewers.
Or our listeners, you should say.
These
episodes are recorded before we have the technological capacity to transmit our conversations into your brain. And have just visual simulacrum of Alex and I sitting around drinking tea and wine and talking about movies.
Yeah.
God, well, that's dystopic.
Either way, have you seen any good movies recently? Have I seen any good movies lately?
Oh, boy. You know, actually, I have. I've seen a few good movies at school this week. And I would say that... And, of course, watching a couple of the Miklos Jangso films in preparation for this podcast. It was my first time coming to him as a filmmaker, and I was really happy with that, and I'm really curious about checking out more of his work. But I would say, honestly, like, if I had to give a recommendation for the week, it is sort of a thing of a change of pace, really. And it's a 2016 film that you might have heard of when it came out. It's Mia Hansen-Løve's... Things to Come, or as its French title is called, L'Avenir, or The Future. And it stars Isabelle Huppert, and she plays this professor, or this teacher, and she's been a longtime teacher, and she's in Paris, and essentially the plot is very, very simple, where it's about her and her navigating a 25-year marriage to a husband that is coming to an end after she is told by him that he has been seeing someone else. Her mother, who's played by Edith Scobe, who some of you might recognize from Eyes Without a Face and Holy Motors, her mother is suffering from severe panic attacks and... early onset dementia. She began her pursuit of political philosophy as something of a radical, and now she's, of course, mellowed out with older age. But now that her husband is leaving her, now that her mother has passed away, and that her kids have moved out, she's sort of beginning to transition into what can be called the autumnal years of her life, and that includes reconnecting with an old student of hers who has grown into this radical leftist who has met with a bunch of like-minded intellectuals to form a farm on outside of Paris, and it's just a collective where they create cheese and talk about political philosophy and how to reinvigorate a sense of collective solidarity among the left and the working class. And you know, this is all one of those things that on paper, this whole film, the story sounds not too different from something like, God forbid, Eat, Pray, Love, where it's a woman who finds her own sense of her own identity again after years of being lost in the wilderness. But hopefully with Mia Hansen-Løve's reputation as a writer and director, and from Isabelle Huppert's reputation as an actor, hopefully you'd get the sense that this film is a cut above that particular cloth in its approach and execution of this subject matter. And you'd be right. I think Huppert, who's very well known for a lot of her cold, sometimes frighteningly clinical characters, like in Hanukkah's The Piano Teacher, like in Paul Verhoeven's Elle, like in Claude Chabrol's work as well, it's interesting to see her here still adopt and apply a lot of that quiet fierce intelligence that she has in all those other films, but in something that's less less domineering or as frightening even as some of those other movies. There is this quiet, subtle growth in her awareness of her own station in life and what life has to offer her, and the film doesn't really provide a grandiose declarative statement at the end of what her life is going to be, either in a pedagogical or political or familial sense. It's just simply observing a moment of change and how this moment of change permits this woman to reflect on who she is, who she was as well, and what she's lost, and how that loss provides something of an opportunity to continue growing. And again, that sounds saccharine, but again, these little moments of growth and transformation are as simple as just her out on a farm, finding an empty field somewhere and just reading a book, or her simply utilizing a cat that her mother had as sort of this strange little companion to sort of remark upon her own preconceptions of surviving outside of your zone of comfort. And the film ends on this very quiet, I won't say really, I mean, it's hard to spoil the film like this anyway, but the film ends on this very quiet, very mellow, but actually I found rather touching note in terms of not really resignation, but acceptance of the constant movement of all things into older age, and as long as we are moving into that deeper stage or another stage of life, you know, of how we continue developing and finding conduits of love and growth and curiosity as people and as in relation to ourselves and in relation to other people. It's a very low-key gem that was kind of overshadowed at the time by Verhoeven's Elle, because Huppert was nominated for the Oscar for that film, and deservedly so. She was fantastic in that film, but she's also great here. And I think it's for no other reason, a great chance to see one of the most beloved modern actresses of her generation give a performance that's not entirely outside of her wheelhouse, but nevertheless offers different shades and complexities that only, I think, affirm her greatness as a performer and as an astute observer of human behavior. So yeah, I was really pleasantly surprised by it, and you know, I it was a really good film to actually watch the day after the debate. It was kind of the soothing balm that I needed.
Yeah, I didn't know whether to mention the debate, but
we don't have to. Yeah, we really don't have to talk about it. But I, you know, everyone who's listening to this is going to be like, yeah.
Yeah, but now they'd be like, we've talked enough about this. But you know, I just wanted to add, like, hearing about this movie, I would like to check it out. It sounds very good. And Huppert is one of those actresses who, I agree with you, she's a phenomenal actress. And it is nice to see that when she plays, I mean, she's great at playing those, like, intensely dark roles. But it's also great to see her play something that a character who maybe is not necessarily going into those kinds of depths that, you know, or those intensities that you see in some of the films you mentioned, but also could be even in her lighter roles like Claire's Camera. I still think she has this natural presence that people gravitate towards, and I think that's what makes her such a great actor.
And I will say that, yeah, and I think what's great too about the film is that Love's direction really matches Huppert's energy, or vice versa. I mean, the first stretch of this film, it's a lot of the camera work is just a lot of these whip pans and these tracking shots that are following her. I mean, there's no music, really, and the film is completely bathed in this gorgeous sunlight, so it's a lovely film to look at, but there is this feeling of perpetual motion that Huppert is undertaking, and you're just kind of dragged along with her. And I mean, she's constantly thinking, constantly doing, constantly, and then that constant motion just slows down, and with it, it's not that the film stops as much as it just begins to adopt this more contemplative air,
And when it does that, then it actually quietly and sneakily disarms you, I think, and provides this very nice, I mean, I don't want to say nice in a patronizing way, but this very soothing and very intelligent regard for just people growing and still having the capacity to grow and not just stop. And yeah.
Well, that sounds like a terrific film. I'd love to check it out. The film I want to recommend is a bit different, though. It was something I was curious in checking out. I saw it just before I left Mubi, actually, but it's kind of considered a huge, significant film for a country's history. And this movie that I want to check out is a huge marker on Indian cinema, actually. It is called Mughal-e-Azam. It was released in 1960 and is based on a poem, The Legend of Anarkali, which is about the tale of forbidden love between Prince Salim and Anarkali, who was a court dancer, and how their love affair is disapproved of by his father, the emperor, and this leads to lots of, as you can imagine, like in these kinds of legendary fables, there are high tensions, the lovers are separated, tensions rise between father and son to the point where son declares war against his father, and so you have these like extravagant sets, these hundreds of extras, including on horseback and elephants. And you also have, naturally, some songs in it. And I thought I mentioned this movie because of, like I said, it was kind of a huge film for its time in India. It clocks in at 197 minutes, and it was actually, for 15 years, the highest-grossing movie in India's history. And it also tackles a lot of... it also makes some pretty progressive grounds for the time period. Like, actually... It probably was the first major Indian film to have a love story between a Muslim and a Hindu. The prince is Muslim, and the girl is a Hindu. So that kind of, you know, those all, I think, make for some, you know, makes it for a pretty landmark and major significant piece of cinema. But also watching the film itself, I was many times, and this was in a black and white form it was shot in. Like, the film was mainly shot in black and white, with the exception of a couple of color sequences. And this wasn't because of any creative decision by the director, but because at the point while they were shooting it, they then, you know, other movies started shooting it in color in India. So then they decided to give it a try, and he thought it looked really cool, and he wanted to reshoot the whole movie again in color. But the producers at this point, because that's such a long production history, balked at that, and they're like, no, you gotta finish this. So it's kind of weird watching the final film, that it's mainly black and white, but you get these couple of sequences, including the climax, they're in color. But I think it also, and the print that I saw, black, it wasn't the greatest of prints, but still, I could admire what I was watching at. Like I said, again, the look of it, it's very much a, you know, it takes a piece of history, but of course takes creative liberties with it, but gives it this high fantasy fable-esque kind of quality to the tale, through the set designs in the world. Like, there are lots of these mirrors which appear in the palace, and I hear it was a nightmare, difficult to shoot with these mirrors, the lights bouncing off of them, but it creates for this very beautiful kind of, this beautiful, exquisite look to it that I think really applies to it. And then they're just sequences that I think are terrific. Like, again, I don't want to give anything away, but the climax to it has some unforgettable visuals involving mirrors being shattered or, you know, put aside, and then you see these guards emerge, and it's like clad in black, and it's like this illusion being shattered away. And again, with all the struggle of crying for unity, and I think that's interesting considering the tensions which rose between India and Pakistan over the years. And actually, it was one of the few movies which would eventually get re-released in Pakistan following its 1965 ban on Indian films. So with all that, I think it's a very important piece of cinema history. And if you're a Bollywood fan, if you're a film of Indian cinema, then of course this is an essential must-see for anyone to check out.
Fantastic. And is that on Mubi or...
On Mubi, but actually when I saw it was the last day that it was streaming on it, so I just got to see it before it left.
rats. Well, I'm just glad.
Hopefully they'll bring it back again, though. If you can find it somewhere else, then I say check it out. I do highly recommend it.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'll definitely have to keep my eyes peeled for that one. I'm always, I'm definitely looking to expand my knowledge of Indian cinema beyond Satyajit Rai and Rifa Gatak, and some of the parallel cinema. That's great. That's fantastic. I'm really glad you liked the film so much. I think those are both really great recommendations, very wildly different recommendations for the week. And I think it's, again, a testament to, with this triumvirate of films, I think it's a testament to the array of movies that are available to watch out there from so many different eras, from the 20th and the 21st century. And we'd be curious to hear your guys' thoughts on, first and foremost, of course, Bel-Atar and Werkmeister Harmonies, what your thoughts are on him as a filmmaker, his placement within Eastern European cinema, or specifically Hungarian cinema, how, if Werkmeister is his best, or if maybe there's somebody out there who actually is trying to make the case for Damnation, or even his TV movie of Macbeth, which I've never seen, but I'm definitely curious to check out if I can ever find it at some point. And of course, if there's a favorite Isabelle Huppert role or movie, feel free to let us know in the comments as well. I know somebody out there has to be a diehard Heaven's Gate fan who's just itching to write an effusive essay about her performance in it. And I mean, you know, go for it. I would love to read it.
I believe there are Heaven's Gate lovers out there. And,
oh, there definitely
are. I also add, like, if you're fans of also, maybe if you also, do you have a favorite Fassbinder film with Hanna Shigulia? Or even, funny enough, the actor who plays Janus, Lars Rudolph. Do you have a favorite role of his, like maybe this, or Run Lola Run? Or do you have a favorite Bollywood film? We'd love to hear your thoughts.
In whatever case, then, as always, thank you so much for joining us for this great trip through cinema history. And we hope that you all stay well, be safe, and continue watching great movies.
Take care, everyone. We're all in this together.